The party that is Book Expo America prepares to welcome guests to New York City, and even the growing Donnybrook that is the Department of Justice case against several major publishers can't spoil the fun. Welcome, everyone. My name is Christopher Keneally, and every week, Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series, Beyond the Book, speaks with the editors and reporters of Publishers Weekly for a look at the week ahead. Joining us on the line from his office in New York is Andrew Albanese, PW's Features Editor. Andrew, welcome back to Beyond the Book.
Hey there, Chris.
And you've been poring over some court documents and giving us a glance at what the fighting position is of the several publishers in this now increasingly heated case. Tell us what you found.
Yeah, some fascinating reading. And I love the term Donnybrook. I'm going to have to steal that from you and use it in a story at some point. But yes, in separate actions this week, both Penguin and Macmillan strongly rejected the charges that they colluded with other major publishers to artificially inflate the prices of ebooks. Apple also denied that in a separate filing. Now, the Penguin brief makes for especially good reading. Macmillan's brief, however, cuts to the chase. Macmillan says that the DOJ case piles innuendo on top of innuendo, stretches facts, and implies actions that did not occur and which Macmillan denies unequivocally. Pretty strong stuff. Penguin's brief, on the other hand, goes into much more detail and really tears away at the government's case, from the DOJ's portrayal of the publishing and ebook markets to emails that supposedly implicated publishing executives in some kind of scheme, and even those now infamous dinners in the wine cellar at Pichelene. Now, as you know, the DOJ has claimed that publishers who were panicked over Amazon's $9.99 Kindle prices conspired with Apple to devise an alternate ebook market. The publishers now offer a competing narrative. No conspiracy, and Amazon is in fact the monopolist. So, did publishers, did their fear of Amazon actually drive the top executives to some kind of conspiracy? And what about those emails and all those calls and private dinners the DOJ cites? Well, in the Penguin brief, it's really interesting. Penguin claims that the emails that the government uses as evidence are taken way out of context. And in fact, they show some of the sentences that were redacted that seem to say that seems to show that they are out of context. In fact, it seems like bookish. The joint venture between these publishers is actually what these emails are all about. Most of these emails are from 2009, before the Apple iPad was around and the iBookstore was ever even a thought in anyone's mind outside of Apple. And those private dinners among CEOs, hey, purely social matters, Penguin claims, where issues and trends were discussed only at a high level of generality. And John Makinson, Penguin CEO, attended those dinners after getting some antitrust counsel from the Penguin lawyers. So this is, as you say, certainly going to get interesting this summer. And as you know, litigation is always a dicey complex, especially when you have three publishers settling charges and two fighting on. But these filings show that the light is also going to shine pretty brightly on Amazon here.
Well, it's not going to be a very quiet summer for those parties, but things are quieting down between Amazon and an important partner.
Yes. So right before Memorial Day, IPG, the Independent Publishing Group, announced that they'd reached a deal to restore IPG's ebooks to Amazon. Now, you may remember that Amazon pulled IPG's titles in February after a push for better terms and higher co-ops from IPG clients broke down. Since late 2011, Amazon has reportedly been meeting with publishers and distributors looking for, among other things, co-op on ebooks. Now, Amazon is always tight-lipped on its negotiations, but the company did say that it believes the investments it's made in its Kindle market warrants a better deal for them. And, given everything that's going on, there's so much you can read into that statement. I'm not even going to get started today. This was an ugly situation, and I hope we've all learned a little bit from it, especially when it comes to DRM, which is the thing that kind of enables these lock-ins to platforms like Kindles. And I'm beginning to think maybe we have learned a little bit of a lesson there, because on the DRM front this week, Momentum Books, Penn Macmillan's Australia digital-only imprint, announced that by early August, all its titles would now be released without DRM. And Momentum's publisher explicitly noted that DRM does restrict consumers from legitimate uses, like shifting books between e-reading devices. And that move also follows the lead of Momentum's sister company, Tor, in the United States. So, yes, some interesting news and some good news, I think, about Amazon there.
Well, summer will be here shortly, and it's a short season, but a lovely one. Anything else you've got for us to look forward to?
Absolutely. So Monday's issue is going to include our annual summer reading feature. You know, and we talked a little bit about the summer reading season last week in connection with E.L. James and 50 Shades of Grey and all that success. So what else is hot? You know, no pun intended there with Shades of Grey. You can check out Monday's issues for a few suggestions. But overall, mild winter and a strong first quarter has contributed to a pretty sunny outlook for this summer for many booksellers. And while we expect 50 Shades of Grey and The Hunger Games to continue to sell well throughout the summer months, there's also new books from Martin Amis, Dave Eggers, and Alan First. So check out the summer reading feature in Monday's issue.
Well, we can look forward to that if we get some time, because next week is Book Expo, and it's going to be a busy week for you and everyone at Publishers Weekly.
That's right, and it's finally here. You know, a couple of weeks ago, we did the special show on the BEA Experience for Libraries, and that really kind of got me excited for this year's show. You know, I always enjoy BEA. It's a crazy, busy week, of course. You know, in addition to our usual magazine and website coverage, we also publish a show daily, and it's also party time with lots of parties in the evening. But it's, you know, it's wonderfully busy, not just crazy busy, and it's always great to see so many people come together in our industry under one roof. Now, we've already published our BEA preview, and if you're still looking for things to do while you're in New York City, check out our April 27th issue. It's all available for free online at publishersweekly.com, and there's lots of good stuff in there. And we also discussed a couple of weeks ago the great speakers this year. I'm particularly looking forward to Stephen Colbert and, of course, the great Neil Young. But what really has me excited about this year's BEA is that we now have something that we didn't get in our healthcare plan, which is a public option.
A public option. Well, that's right, because we're going to see members of the public this time.
That's right. This year, the public is going to come in on the final day of the show. And I'm really excited for that to begin. And it's all happening a year earlier than had originally been floated. And I'll make just a few quick observations about this. First, it's going to be a controlled experiment. There's only 1,000 tickets that are being distributed. And as you know, the Javits Center is enormous. So adding 1,000 more people to the Javits Center over the course of a day is going to be like throwing a few deck chairs on the Queen Mary. So I don't think we should expect too much too quickly. I think this year it's a little more of a get your feet wet thing, but I think that's very smart. I think it's a good way to sort of test out how the public is going to react to BEA. Also, there aren't going to be consumer sales on the floor, not this year, not anytime soon, I don't think. But you can see where this is all going. You know, in our preview, one bookseller, the co-owner of Greenlight's Books in Brooklyn, actually, I think it was, said that she hoped the show would eventually grow to be like Comic-Con. Now, that would be an incredible outcome, you know, just for the costumes alone, I hope. But that's not going to come overnight, obviously. And I'll say this too, for all the talk in recent conferences from executives about the need for publishing to become a more consumer-oriented business, in other words, going from this business-to-business setup to a more business-to-consumer setup, this is a really nice step in that direction. And I think it fits nicely with another initiative too, which is the You Publish You part of the show, which is dedicated to self-publishing. And I know you're part of that, Chris, and maybe you want to say a couple of words about your session?
I'd be happy to, Andrew. Thanks for that. You know, the thing that you were referring to is this dissolving of boundaries that's happening throughout the industry, the lines that used to separate authors and publishers and readers and all the other parties involved are really starting to blur together, and we're seeing that in the self-publishing area particularly. So we will be getting a head start on Book Expo on Sunday with the program called You Publish You, and I'll be moderating the keynote panel, and it's going to feature two leading self-publishing advocates, people who are very strongly pro self-publishing for all kinds of reasons: Mark Coker, the CEO of Smashwords, and Bob Young, who is CEO and founder of Lulu. They come at things with slightly different perspectives, and we might even see a few sparks fly. But I think the very special guest is going to be Jenny Pedroza, who's from the Writer's Coffee House. And what we should say about Writer's Coffee House is they got started by discovering E.L. James. They were the ones who first made it possible for 50 Shades of Grey to come online. And with that, I suppose they don't need much more to get their business started. Jenny's been a third grade teacher in Texas for a number of years. She's leaving that job, getting on a plane, and heading to New York to talk to us. So we look forward to having her.
Well, I'm really looking forward to that session as well. In fact, it's one of the highlights that I'm most looking forward to at BEA this year. So I look forward to seeing you there, Chris.
We will see you there, Andrew, as well as everyone else on online and in our audience. We look forward to having you join us. And joining us, as always, with the review of this week's reviews is Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, who blogs at Genreville. Welcome back to Beyond the Book, Rose.
Thank you, Chris. Always a pleasure.
Well, it's good to have you back with us. We're looking forward to BEA, but these books that are just coming out the door. They won't be talking about them at BEA, but there might be people carrying them under their arms. So what have we got in the fiction section?
We have a Q&A with Nigerian-born author Sefi Adda. She talks to us about her new novel, A Bit of Difference, which is about Western conceptions of Africa and about being an African living in Mississippi. And she says, I have a room of my own. I wave to my neighbors as I drive past them. We don't talk about politics or religion, so we get along. There's a big review of an extraordinary debut, Amanda Copland's The Orchardist. In the book, a reclusive man, the orchardist of the title, attempts to reclaim two young sisters, both of them pregnant by the same man, a violent opium-addicted brothel owner, and he rescues them from a harrowing fate in a verdant valley in the Pacific Northwest early in the 20th century. Elsewhere in reviews, we're pretty excited about The Light Between Oceans by M.L. Stedman, a deftly crafted debut that asks what happens when a baby washed up on an island populated only by a lighthouse keeper and his wife, who failed to have children of their own. And Triberbia, an absorbing first novel that brings to life the capacious lofts, self-involved chefs, and occasional rent control holdouts of Manhattan's affluent Tribeca neighborhood. We're also pleased about our profile of Megan Abbott, who, after several standout books written in the noir genre, follows her mainstream breakout, The End of Everything, with Dare Me, which you could call Fight Club with pom-poms. And Abbott talked to our writer about writing what she knows, which in this case was the dangerous whimsy of the bored suburban teenager.
In mystery and thrillers, you've got a couple books connected to the UK.
Yeah, we do. We have a really interesting signature review. This was written by author Stephen Annable, who's a mystery author. And as you know, PW's reviews are usually anonymous, but every once in a while we get in a big name to review another big name. So Stephen Annable reviews Ruth Rendell's The Saint Zita Society, in which the help who work in a London street, Hexham Place, meet to drink and grouse at a local pub where they inaugurate the Saint Zita Society, a kind of free-willing union named after the patron saint of servants. And meanwhile, a killer and an accomplice brainstorm about stashing a body. And we also have a big review of Charles Cumming's A Foreign Country, which opens in 1978 Tunisia, where Amelia Weldon, who's a 20-year-old British au pair, is having an affair with her French-born employer. And then flash forward to the present when Weldon, who's about to become the chief of the UK's secret intelligence service, disappears. And a disgraced former MI6 operative has to follow the trail to Tunisia. In science fiction, we review the 35th anniversary edition of George R. R. Martin's first novel, Dying of the Light. Obviously, George Martin's name is now best connected with Game of Thrones, but this was long before he got into epic fantasy. It's actually an unusually gloomy and violent take on the interstellar adventure story. And our reviewer says it's a young writer's book full of romantic foreboding and foolishness, but it still demonstrates Martin's virtuoso mastery of atmosphere. Lilith St. Crow, like George Martin, has also tried just about every genre of fantasy, and now she turns to steampunk with The Iron Worm Affair. That's W-Y-R-M, because Ys are more steampunk, I guess. And this is a delightfully Holmesian romp, complete with a dynamic duo who are, for real, just good friends. And she has been writing a fair amount of YA, so the lack of romance in this book will make it an appealing crossover for her younger fans. And it also keeps the focus on action and deduction.
It's time for summer, which is often time for romance, but one of the romance novels you're reviewing has a Christmas theme.
Yeah, the June 4th issue is our summer romance focus issue, but that doesn't stop us from covering books that are coming out in late fall, and that's when the Christmas romances show up. They usually are set to publish in October. The first one we got in is His Mistletoe Bride by Vanessa Kelly. This is a Regency romance with an unusual main character. She's a pacifist Quaker from America, but she ends up in a forced marriage to a British war hero. And as they learn to find common ground, they also explore some historical Christmas traditions at their aptly named home, Mistletoe Manor. We also review Julie Ann Walker's riveting debut romantic suspense novel, Hell on Wheels, in which a high-tech motorcycle shop hides a black ops group that does side jobs for Uncle Sam. So no pacifists here. And a former Marine falls for his best buddy's sister while protecting her from the machinations of a crooked senator. Our reviewer calls it a first-rate thrill ride. And we've got lots more for romance fans in this issue, including a Q&A with romance author Tony Blake, who talks about why romance writing pulled her away from a promising career in literary fiction. In the comics section, we have an interesting adaptation of The Odyssey by Seymour Twost, whose name I hope I'm pronouncing correctly. It's the latest in a sort of unofficial series of graphic novels based on the classics. And he's a veteran illustrator and graphic designer who interprets the Greek epic in a sort of whimsical way with line drawings that infest the familiar tale with droll energy. And our reviewer says, actually, given the rich cast of characters and wealth of dramatic incident, it's a surprise that the Odyssey hasn't seen more visual interpretations. And this one is quite enjoyable, if lightweight. In nonfiction, we cover How the French Invented Love, 900 Years of Passion and Romance. There's another one for those romance fans. Marilyn Yellum takes readers on an enchanting tour of French literature from Abelard and Héloïse in the 17th century to Marguerite Duras in the 20th and Philippe Soler in the 21st. We're attempting to unravel the mystery of how the French manage their romances, marriages, affairs, and the national obsession with love and sex. And Yellum is a former professor of French and current senior scholar at Stanford's Clayman Institute for Gender Research. She's a feminist, a Proustian, an admitted Simone de Beauvoir groupie, and otherwise the perfect companion for this particular tour. And our reviewer says readers will want to run to the library and stay there for a year reading everything that she deconstructs. In The Seed Underground, A Growing Revolution to Save Food, which is sort of part memoir, part botany primer, and part political manifesto, Janice Ray has a mission to inspire us with her own life to understand food at its most elemental. She calls it the most hopeful thing in the world. And avid gardeners will relish recognizing their idiosyncratic revolutionary sides in the pages of this book, which is also likely to strike a spark with gardening novices. Also for gardeners, from the backyard in our lifestyle section, British gardening guru Alan Titchmarsh tells Tales from Titchmarsh, A Year in the Garden, which is a collection of essays written by the host of Ground Forced, a garden makeover TV show. And Titchmarsh writes with a friendly and intimate voice, as you would expect from a TV host, making this a breezy read for gardeners who will relate to the tales of aspiration, frustration, and mystification in the garden. We also have a Q&A in the nonfiction section with David K. Randall, author of Dreamland, who says that when it comes to happiness, sleep is more important than eating right or exercising. And our pick of the week is Bill and Hillary, The Politics of the Personal by William H. Chafe. He's a Duke history professor, delivers a superior portrait of how the dynamic between Bill and Hillary Clinton affected their achievements in public life. It starts when they met in law school and goes all the way up to very close to the present day, presenting a sympathetic, if often regretful, account of a stormy, occasionally self-destructive political partnership.
An interesting book, intriguing. We think of Bill and Hillary as political figures, but of course they're also both best-selling authors. And I guess that's a good way to wrap up the review of the reviews with Rose Fox. Rose, we'll see you next week at Book Expo.
I'm looking forward to it.
As are we, and we look forward to seeing you and Andrew Albanese there along with everyone else. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as now images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the podcast series on iTunes or on our website, copyright.com/beyondthebook. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.